All right, so innovative trials and collaborative initiatives. This is a new panel for this Cancer Progress. I've had the fortune of being involved here for 19 years, and I'm really pleased to see that we have this panel. Until about 3 years ago, we didn't even think about including patient advocates and foundations, so this is terrific. We have a superb group of panelists. I'd like to have each of the panelists just do a very brief introduction of who they are, what they do. Then I've got a few slides, and then we'll jump into the discussion. So Lou, you want to start off?
So Lou DiGennaro, I'm the president and CEO of the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Just a word about that organization. We're the third largest cancer not-for-profit in the United States. We've been in existence for nearly 70 years. Since 1994, LLS has, obviously by the name, we're vested in and our interests are in the hematological malignancies. And it's not just leukemia and lymphoma, it's the whole spectrum. All of the diseases that were in that bubble chart that Mike Bryce put up there, we have an interest in. We deliver our mission, as we call it, the programmatic side of what we do in three areas, research, services to patients, and policy and advocacy work. On the research side, since 1994, we've deployed about $1.3 billion in research, both in academic projects at academic centers all around the world and in, since the last 10 years, in partnerships with small biotechnology companies. Last year, the FDA approved 18 new therapies to treat the heme malignancies, combinations of new chemical entities, new modalities, and repurposing of existing drugs. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society touched the discovery or development of 15 out of the 18. So you can get some sense of the impact we've had on the research side. On the patient services side, support groups, education programs, financial aid. Last year we distributed $75 million to needy patients who would not have been able to afford the drugs that they were prescribed without our help. And on the policy and advocacy side, we, because of the kind of organization we are, we have substantial access to both the regulators, the FDA, and the halls of Congress, and we work in the best interests of cancer patients in both those arenas.
Thanks, Lou. Lorraine?
Hi, everybody. I'm Lorraine Egan. I'm the CEO of the Damon Runyon Cancer Research Foundation. And very different kind of organization than LLS in the sense that we're really a boutique organization that focuses on all cancers, but specifically focuses on the human capital part of research. Do we have the right people to make breakthroughs against all forms of cancer? And are we promoting them and identifying, first of all, the best and brightest at the youngest stage? And keeping them in cancer research and giving them the fuel or the resources they need to make the kind of breakthroughs that we're all waiting for here. So we have been around since 1946, and we focus on these early career scientists both, and probably different than a lot of the interest here, we fund a lot of basic science focused on fundamental mechanisms and how can we look at cancer at the most basic level, all the way through to people who are presenting at this conference like Rainier and Dimitri tomorrow, who are more on the translational side of things. And what we try to do is identify gaps that we see in the human capital working on cancer research.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rami Ibrahim. I'm the CMO of the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. Sitting here and listening to the other speakers or other panelists, I feel that we are the new kids on the block because we're only 2 years old. Basically, our focus is to really help some of the academic researchers advance their discoveries and really try to change the idea that the goal is a science paper or a New England publication. We're really trying to work with the scientists to figure out how they can really take their ideas into the clinic and how can this directly help patients. I will have a few slides later on just to give you a better sense of what we do at the Parker Institute, but our focus is more on the R&D part.
Hi, TJ Sharp, and I am the newest kid on the block because I don't even have a foundation yet. So
that makes me old.
I'm a stage 4 melanoma patient, a 2-time clinical trial veteran, including one that involved TIL. So all the adoptive cell transfer you heard earlier, I might be the only person in the room that's actually been on the other side of that getting it. Obviously, the second trial I'm on has worked out well, and my career went from being an IT project manager to being a educated patient voice, someone who can bring not just my story to the clinical research and the pharmaceutical world, but a collective voice, an educated voice as much as a patient could be educated, to insist that we're a part of the drug development process and that not just that we're heard, but that we're actively involved. I get to work with groups like TransCelerate and individual biotechs and pharma companies and CROs to bring that patient voice to them.
Thank you very much. So as you can tell, we've got an extremely knowledgeable panel. So let me just try to frame some of the discussion. First issue is the challenge of recruiting patients. And here's just some numbers from public data. As of 2013, only 3% of adult cancer patients enrolled in cancer clinical trials, which is far too few for the 28,000 oncology trials ongoing and the 1,500 combination trials alone. So you don't have to be my son learning linear algebra to figure out this is a mathematical words are not a good answer today. So we'll be curious to hear from our panelists about how to address this huge gap between the number of new agents that need to be tested and the paucity of patients available to test them. Second, we're going to hear a little bit from our panelists later on. There's some structural issues such as the cost issue, availability of drugs, proximity to the right cancer centers, inclusion-exclusion criteria. And the fundamental question, which we hope to hear a little bit from our group today, is the role of patient advocates, foundations to help recruit patients. And clearly, there's been tremendous success on the orphan drug side on doing that. And for cancer, increasingly, we're dealing with, as we heard from the last panelist, orphan drugs, which are under broad rubrics of cancers. So this is issue one, which is the challenge of recruiting patients. Second big question we heard a little bit even last panel is the regulatory framework. And to give them credit where credit's due, the FDA, despite all the disparagement about the government that goes on publicly, has done a very nice job of increasing the pathways to approval. Over a 5-year period of the 174 new drugs that were approved, 60% of those had at least one expedited program, including breakthrough or fast-track designation. And FDA continues to be creative, to give them credit, such as the recent approval of J&J's drug for prostate cancer with a new endpoint of metastasis-free survival is just one example. And we heard earlier from Dr. Esterman from UCSF about the I-SPY 1 and 2 programs and some of the new adaptive trials. And so there's been a lot of progress there, but clearly the question is what can foundations, what can patient advocates do going forward to continue to improve on the oncology regulatory review? And I think we'll hear a little bit from both the IO focus of the newer groups like Parker, as well as groups like Mr. De Janeiro's group about different approaches that are contemplated to improve on these issues. And then a third issue, the foundations and nonprofits have been there, as you've heard, for many years, Damon Runyon since 1946, but there's increasing risk that the thesis we all believe for the last 45 years of the war on cancer guaranteeing government funding is not necessarily a assumption we can no longer believe in. The current administration, this is not a political statement, it's just a statement of fact, sent a budget request for a 20% decrease in NIH funding, which would have ripped $6 billion out of the funding from NIH alone. And during the last major sequestration, 2012-2013, 722 fewer grants were funded. So the assumption that we've always had that the government's there will fund cancer research is not necessarily an assumption going forward. And at the same time as there's a question about the government's commitment, we're seeing new modalities and new approaches of foundations. The CF Foundation quite visibly got Royalty Pharma to pay $3 billion in the Kalydeco royalties, which has changed the nature of cystic fibrosis funding. And clearly Vertex has benefited, but a number of other organizations have now access to funding there. The Parker Institute has publicly stated, and we'll hear more from Mami, to commit $250 million just for the new approaches for cancer immunotherapy. And the ongoing funding from Damon Runyon has led to 12 of the scientists are receiving Nobel Prizes. So foundations and patient advocates, which historically had not necessarily been the center of cancer drug development, are becoming increasingly important. So with that as a little bit of backdrop, let me start with the first question on the role of patient advocates in recruiting patients. And maybe, TJ, I'll ask you to kick off a little bit. Why are so few patients who've got cancer not going to get into clinical trials?
They don't know. They are unaware of where to find a trial, how to navigate looking for trials. Going on to clinicaltrials.gov is an exercise in futility for even people who are educated in this. Too many patients take what their doctor gives them or maybe get a second opinion, but aren't knowledgeable enough to actually do the background work to sift through the 26,000 trials that are out there and understand this might be my best next choice or this fits in my treatment plan here. And that gets frustrating, especially when you're staring down the, you know, into a, the face of a cancer diagnosis. It's that much more difficult to process. So the navigation to a trial and understanding where it fits in a treatment plan is probably the biggest hurdle that most patients face.
Lou, I think you had some data on how you've dealt with this.
Yeah, thank you. So I think TJ's spot on there. I think I would extend that a little bit further. There are a lot of myths about clinical trials. I'm going to be a guinea pig. I'm going to have a placebo. So I think that's part of what leads to patient confusion. I think access is critically important. Patients are frequently, even when a clinical trial may be the best treatment for a patient, they're not always offered access to a trial, depending on where they're diagnosed. Particularly if they're diagnosed and being treated in a community setting, they may not be offered a clinical trial. We've been working at this for quite some time, so one of the patient services that we provide is that we run a clinical trial matching service. If a patient connects with us and expresses an interest in being on a clinical trial, we help them navigate TJ clinicaltrials.gov to find a trial in their geography that they might be eligible for. I think even more importantly, we teach them how to have a conversation with their physician about getting on a clinical trial so they can go back to their physician and have that conversation and seek appropriate treatment. We can guide them to, and we do, guide them to physicians for second opinions, for example, and really try to bring up their level of understanding so that they can have that conversation and perhaps find a trial that they're eligible for. What we know is that you had the statistic of only 3% of cancer patients enroll in clinical trials. It's a little bit better for the heme malignancies. It's closer to about 10 or 12%, but still pretty low. What we know is when we speak with a patient through this clinical trial matching service, they enroll in a trial 60% of the time. So with that empowering information, they're able to make a choice for themselves.
Remy?
Yeah, I think there are two parts of this problem. There is the patient awareness, but also the fact that most of those patients are being seen at the community hospitals. Most of us, when we open clinical trials, we go to the big comprehensive cancer centers. It's very interesting when you look at the reports from clinical trials and you look at the demographics, you would think that the U.S. is 92% white, 5% black, and then maybe 3% Asians, which is not really a representation of the actual demographics in the country. So part of the problem is the community hospitals, they don't have access to clinical trials, and the oncologists, they are more comfortable giving the standard of care that they are used to prescribing to their patients. So there are few, and we are not an organization that actually that does patient advocacy work, but there's the cancer support community, there is the ACCC. So there are a few organizations that are focusing on the training of the community hospital oncologists so that they are aware of clinical trials and they know how to manage patients on a clinical trial. And then similar to what LLS is doing, there are many organizations now that started the patient navigators. And those are highly trained individuals who are volunteers, but they are helping the patient understand, even for some patients when they go into clinicaltrials.gov, for them, they have a result of 150 studies that is in melanoma, but it's not clear to me which one of them is a good option for me. So the patient navigators really help patients understand the clinical trials, and also understand many of the newer reports that we're getting right now with the sequencing. Again, I get a report and I look at it and I have no idea what does that mean with regards to the treatment that I should be getting. So there are many groups now that are trying to address the issue where including minorities in clinical trials and increasing the awareness and trying to talk with them about the fact that if you go to a clinical trial, that doesn't make you a guinea pig, or that what they are trying to do is to help you rather than trying to collect samples from you. And then I think training of the community hospitals would be a very important part of this.
Did you want to talk about this, Lorraine, or you want to skip to the FDA discussion?
I just also wonder whether there are financial disincentives for the community physician to send a patient off to a clinical trial, and maybe that's a barrier to them talking and being aggressive with their patients about getting them into trials. So, you know, financial barriers are probably pretty significant.
Jeremy, could I add something? And Lorraine, I think you're spot on there. There clearly are disincentives for physicians to enroll patients in clinical trials, something we should really look to try to solve. Remy reminded me of something that we've just kicked off, two things actually, because I think it's not just the patient that doesn't necessarily understand the trials that are available and which might be the optimal trial, it's the physician as well. We've just opened up a partnership with the American Society of Hematology, and we've offered access to this clinical trial matching service to 63 of their members, 63 hematologists, mostly in community centers, to pilot and ask if we offered this kind of navigation to clinical trials, not to the patient, but to the physician, would it help them understand which trials to enroll their patients in? And to the point about the genetics becoming more and more important, it certainly is. I mean, you couldn't help but appreciate that from the last panel, how complex the genetics is in the hemalignancies and how important that is. We're looking to add to this clinical trial matching service a program that involves genetic counseling as well. Because if anyone's seen a Foundation Medicine report, a HEME-1 report, it's about this thick. Patients certainly don't know how to interpret it, and I would posit that most physicians don't either in terms of actionable information. I think we heard Bill Matsui say that. So we're going to try to offer that as well to provide additional support for the physician to be able to make a smarter decision about how to treat their patient.
Very good. Thank you. By the way, if there are questions that come up for each section, please feel free to, there's microphones of both sides, please feel free to join. Switching for a second to the role of nonprofits and patients with the FDA and regulatory, maybe TJ, I'll just ask you to start again. One of the things that's happened is NORD and the orphan disease has done a phenomenal job of changing the landscape of orphan disease approvals. What's going on in terms of oncology?
We aren't quite where they are. You can see that the model, probably piloted by the HIV community, is starting to be adopted. Patients are being brought in. The FDA does do a good job. They've launched a number of initiatives to pull in the voice of the patient. We heard it earlier. I don't think it's necessarily the regulatory agency's fault, for lack of a better word, that the embracing of patients as an equal partner isn't happening. It has to be on all sides. So the regulatory world can only listen to patients talk so much before something actionable has to happen, and that's not going to come from the government side. It's going to come from the people who are designing trials and executing them.
Other panels, Lori or Lou?
My observation is that there's a sea change going on in terms of awareness of the need to involve patients in clinical trials to make them successful and to have them involved in the upfront development of the trials. And I think that's an extraordinary thing that's going on right now that I see a lot in the not-for-profit space. It's not where we are in terms of what we fund, but I'm sure you have that going on, Lou.
Yeah, I can validate what TJ said. I'll give you a specific example. One of our areas of focus right now is acute myeloid leukemia. We took 14 AML patients and 7 caregivers to a meeting with the FDA about a year ago as we were kicking this program off. Dr. Pazder, the head of oncology at the FDA, Ann Farrell, the head of hematology, about 20 FDA staffers gave us 5 hours of their time.
Wow.
Cloistered with these patients. And I can tell you they were not on their phones or on their iPads. There was a true dialogue between the FDA and the patients in the room. They were really seeking to understand better patient preferences and what patients wanted out of treatment for their disease. So I can validate from firsthand what TJ just said about an openness on the part of the FDA. I think not-for-profits have a unique role and a unique ability to meet with the regulatory agencies. We're not shilling a product, and we have found a very open door to the FDA. I'm not sure, TJ and I disagree about this. I don't think we can influence the FDA, but we can certainly educate them. And to the extent that we can bring validated medical and scientific understanding, the understanding of the unmet medical need that patients have, and the understanding of the science and the medicine behind the disease, we can position them to make a smarter decision about when they make a regulatory decision. I think that's our role. The FDA has even asked us in the past to submit draft guidance or help them create draft guidance in a particular area. So they seek us to bring validated information to them. And I think it's an important role that every not-for-profit can play.
So I'll just add like two things, because I think we can influence the FDA, and it happened. Friends of Cancer Research were a big force behind the breakthrough designation, which is something that the FDA did not have before, and now for promising agents, FDA is granting now a sort of an expedited review, and they make themselves available so that they can talk with company and bring those medicines to patients earlier. So that's something that Friends of Cancer Research was key in making happen. The other piece in pediatrics, recently they've started giving the pediatric vouchers, and also a nonprofit group was behind this. So I think there are ways where nonprofit can really talk with the about policies and how we can change the way that we've been reviewing and assessing promising agents.
Let me jump in with one more thing, because I thought of it as you guys were talking. There is a good opportunity for advocacy organizations especially to bring that collective voice to push for change. I use clinicaltrials.gov as an example because we just talked about it, but that's not going to change until patients and physicians demand that it's a better tool. It's the same thing when it comes to expanded access. That's another good example that's recent, that the breakthrough designation. All these happen not because an industry person wanted to have them, because the people who are getting the medicines said, this is what we want as consumers of a product, of a good. And that weight of a collective group of people demanding change is the real opportunity for us to make a difference as patients and as advocates.
Excellent. Okay, once again, I will take questions, or Michael King, I'm going to call on you, cold call if you don't come with questions. How do nonprofits and foundations work with companies? And the best illustration here is Vertex 10 years ago was worth about $2 billion. It's now worth $30 billion. And largely, you could say the CF Foundation's funding, in addition to their innovative drugs, now they can sell $2 billion a year, and they're just changing the nature of CF, largely because of support from the foundation. How do you think about it in terms of oncology? Who wants to start on this?
Maybe I can start. So 10 years ago, almost 11 years ago now, we put in place at the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society a program, we call it the Therapy Acceleration Program, where we partner with small biotechnology companies. What we saw in 2007 were small companies that had agents that might be active in the blood cancers, but they weren't being developed. And a significant reason for that was lack of capital. So we stepped into that gap. We have, over the past 10 years, provided, for the most part, non-dilutive capital to these companies. It's not a grant. I want to be absolutely clear. We don't give grants to companies. These are business alliances with contracts, timelines, milestones, deliverables. Our dollars are tranched against the deliverables. We're really driving for performance. The stated goal in all of this is in the name of the program,
It's the therapy acceleration program for a reason. We want to accelerate the rate at which these therapies are delivered to patients. So fast forward to today. Last year, two of the small companies we partnered with saw FDA approval. One was Kite Pharmaceuticals with their approval for CAR T therapy in lymphoma. And one was a small company called Celator, then acquired by Jazz, that helped bring one of the first new treatments for acute myeloid leukemia in 30 years to the FDA for approval. I believe this year we'll see an approval, FDA approval for a third company that we've partnered with. In the background, five other companies that we've partnered with have seen third-party deal flow from Big Pharma to the tune of about $750 million in cash into those companies. And if you believe in, somebody mentioned biobucks earlier today, if you believe in out-year milestones, I like to call them biobucks, about $3 billion in pledges to pay with performance. So I think there's a role, a significant role for a not-for-profit. We should be absolutely clear, we bring far more than just dollars to these companies. We bring medical and scientific expertise. We bring a deep understanding of the unmet medical need that patients have. We bring access to all the key opinion leaders because we've been funding their academic research for decades. We bring access to patients. I guess last but not least, we bring the good housekeeping seal of the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society as well. Before somebody asks, yes, there's a financial return on investment built into these contracts. We haven't seen $3 billion come back, but last year we saw in excess of $30 million come back as those agents were approved and went forward. The goal of the program is new therapies and only secondarily a financial return.
We have a question for the audience.
Hi. So I have two questions for you. First, when you say that you're not getting enough patients to get involved in trials, is this across all cancers, or do you find, for example, pediatric cancers where families are more motivated to get involved, look for solutions? And then the second question is, I don't know if you're familiar with the Army of Women. If you could talk a little bit about their model of getting patients involved in trial design and determining what should be measured within the trials, that would be helpful. Thank you.
I'm sure others want to weigh in on this. I can speak a little bit about pediatric blood cancers. You know, since the 1960s, we've taken the survival rate for pediatric leukemia, for acute lymphoblastic leukemia, from 3% to 90%. And there's one clear reason for me that that happened, and that was that in that time frame, pediatric oncologists agreed to put virtually every newly diagnosed child on a clinical trial, number one. And number two, they agreed to share the data going forward, and we were able to make that progress. So today, it is still the case that for children diagnosed with leukemia, the vast majority of them go on clinical trials to continue the advances there. Maybe others have something to say about the other cancers as well. The Army of Women, Dr. Love should be here to talk about that. You know, this is a group of women who openly express a desire to participate in clinical studies and who are willing to bring their knowledge, their preferences, and their participation to bear through this database that Dr. Love has created. Others who are more familiar with the breast cancer field might know a bit more about that.
All right, excellent questions. Thank you for that. Let me switch to the role of nonprofits, and we'll circle back on this. Maybe Lorraine, you could talk a little bit about your role, given the uncertainty of government funding and how you have consistently funded great research and how that's critical for the linchpin of the development of new cancer drugs.
Well, I guess I can kind of bridge the prior discussion about partnering with pharma
Great.
in with what we do. So our most successful partnership with different pharma companies, many of them here in the room, has been in connection with our Clinical Investigator Award. And that was launched probably 18 years ago now, when it was clear that fewer and fewer physicians were going into research, which created this tremendous potential barrier between getting things out of the lab and actually running these clinical trials and having that movement back and forth between the lab and patients. And there was also a concern that in the pharma industry, it's the clinical scientists who are ones that often are, you know, on the teams and the leaders of those organizations. And if there weren't going to be any more clinical investigators, we were going to be in big trouble. And there's a lot of reasons why physicians don't go into research. The pay is lower. They often have medical school debt. The training trajectory takes forever. And the research is really hard, and a number of other reasons. So anyway, we created an award focused on trying to recruit new leaders in clinical cancer research into the field, and Lilly was the founding partner with us on this award and funded over $30 million of the program. And over time, we've brought in Celgene and Novartis and Genentech, and I don't want to leave anyone out. Gilead is here, I notice. But they all came in on the award, first of all, because they knew that they were basically going to be, this was the talent that was going to run their companies in the future. And secondly, these were, since they're early career scientists, they're also the people who are out on the cutting edge and taking risks on new ideas in the field, and they needed to tap that kind of new blood and new energy. So we partner with them, and that continues to this day, and we bring together our scientists with the oncology teams at these companies to share what's going on in the field and potentially collaborate with them. So it's much different in the sense it's not a goal of a specific drug and timelines and deliverables. It's more about the human capital concept of all of this, but equally important to those organizations. And on the second point that you raised about how do you, you know, funding of the NIH and all of that, you know, I think we all know that funding at the NIH was stagnant for so many years and did so much damage to the ability to move things forward. And I think we're seeing actually right now a refreshing bipartisan support in the NIH and some additional funding. But if we're going to bring people into this field to be scientists, we have to make this career better than it is now. It's a really challenging career. You have to really give up a lot in terms of remuneration and quality of life. It's as competitive as anything. So we're very concerned about things like the fact that, you know, for an MD, their first NIH grant now is over 45 years of age, you know. So that's preposterous. Why would anyone go into this field? So we spend a lot of time focused on that issue and advocating with the NIH that we don't need big boluses of new money. We need consistency and predictability. And if we have that, we can make it a good career for scientists, and we can figure out how many people we need and where we need them. So so I don't know that that will ever happen, but that's my dream.
Thank you, Lorraine. Raymond?
Can I present?
Company?
Yeah, can I just present one slide to the clinical trials that we're doing, and I'm sure Duke can also speak to the leukemia study.
Okay. Do we have the slide ready, sir?
Right. So actually, I have a few slides, but I really want to show one slide, which just an example of one of the studies that we're doing. For many people, they always, whenever they hear like a nonprofit organization, they always think of a dollar sign, that the what nonprofits can bring is just funding and just stay away from us, let us do our research. That's not what we do. So for us, can I actually have the slides? Oh. So what we're doing is we're really, and as I said, we just turned two. But let me go to the. Okay. So what we did is, like, we really started building an infrastructure that we can make available to our researchers. So we have a clinical trial management group, we have bioinformatics group, we have research group. We are a very small organization. So, like, right now, we're only 50 people who are working at Presidio in San Francisco. But we really started building those infrastructure and resources that we can make available not only to our researchers, but also available to companies and other nonprofit organizations. So we're working with Cancer Research Institute because it didn't make sense that two immunotherapy organizations would be doing the same type of studies. So we partnered with CRI so that the funding now would come from CRI and from Parker whenever there's an immunotherapy study. And then again, we've been talking with multiple pharma companies so that they can get access to their pipeline and use this to support the combinations that our scientists are interested in. So this is, again, the example of what we are trying to do. So we are right now running a study in frontline pancreatic cancer. The whole idea behind the study came from a work that Bob van der Heide and his team did. Well, they've done a lot of preclinical work that supports that a CD40 plus a PD-1 on a chemotherapy backbone can be more efficacious than just giving chemo alone or giving the IO agents separate. They also did work that supports the schedule. It's not just a matter of let's mix the four together and cross our fingers and hope that nothing will happen. So they did some work that really supports that scheduling of when to give the CD40 or the PD-1 compared to chemotherapy is important. So based on this, we actually launched the frontline pancreatic cancer study. And we broke it down into different pieces. So the first part that we've built is the biobank. So we introduced some standardization to how tissue is being collected, how it's being processed, how it's being stored. And we did the same thing with the blood collection. We've heard today some discussions about the circulating free DNA. And now there's new data that supports that microbiome can have an impact on how patients respond to immunotherapy. So we designed the study in a way that we are collecting tissue, we are collecting blood, and at the same time, we're keeping up with what's happening in the field, such as the microbiome. We are now building the capabilities that can allow us to do beyond the standard immune monitoring that we usually do in clinical trials. So right now we have the multi-parameter, the X50 flow cytometry. We're giving them access to the CyTOF, and obviously we're doing some cytokine profiling. Tissue imaging is becoming an area of a great interest, and right now maybe is a new instrument that's developed or it came out of Stanford. So we're helping them validate the instrument, and we're making this available again to our members. There's the vector or the multiplex immunohistochemistry. So we're really trying to bring new tools that can help the scientists generate more data. For many companies, the approach is if you really want to understand whether an agent or a combination works, is instead of enrolling 20 patients, try to enroll 100 or 150 patients, and you usually make decisions based on a clinical endpoint. So here we're trying to really figure out, based on a small sample size, whether the combination working or not, and if it's not working, then what's wrong with the combination. And then the bioinformatics group is helping with the integration of all this data so that we can make sense of the totality of the data rather than what we do right now, which is you have the clinical data, you have the genetics data, you have the flow data, and it's very difficult to integrate everything into one place. And then the clinical trial team is actually able now to help the investigators put an IND together. We hold the IND and we actually function as the sponsor for the clinical trial. Companies like this, obviously part of it because we are taking the liability of running the study, but I think what's more exciting is companies now don't have to enter an agreement early on. So they give us access to their molecules. We are the IND holder. We are contracting with the two different companies separately. And only when we deliver the data, if they feel that the data is intriguing or supports next steps, at that point they can enter an agreement. We will never develop drugs, so we will never take drugs into registrational studies. That's something that we decided that we will not be doing because of the limited resources that we have. But if we can ensure that the quality of the data that we're generating meets industry standards, now the experiment doesn't have to be repeated, like in many cases now with investigator-sponsored studies. I completely agree with the comment that was made earlier today that the best ideas are coming from academia, but also there is the quality of the data, because those are usually done at a single institute with limited resources. And then obviously we have a business development group that works with the companies to establish those agreements. And again, here, just one example that shows that we are using a CD40 that's coming from a small startup. We're using the PD-1 that's coming from BMS, and obviously the chemo backbone is standard of care. So again, this is just one example of how we can be more than just a source of funding. And by the way, we are funding the studies, so we do fund studies, but we have to really believe in the novelty of the approach. But then we also rely on other groups, other nonprofit organizations to help us with the co-funding. And if pharma is willing to put or to contribute towards the cost of the clinical trial, we're very open to doing this.
Thank you, Ruby. Any questions about what he just described in terms of what the Parker Institute is doing?
So, Jeremy, if I could hitchhike on that a little bit. So in a similar way, and I think this threads together several of the themes we heard. So one of the questions you've asked us is, why don't patients enroll in clinical trials? And I heard Dr. Esserman say it earlier today, if you design the right trial and physicians like the trial and patients like the trial, they will enroll. I think the notion that we've also heard from Dr. Esserman and from Ken Anderson was the need to move novel agents earlier to patients earlier in their diagnosis. And I mentioned our interest in acute myeloid leukemia. So we've taken a lesson from I-SPY and other trials and put together a master protocol, an umbrella study in acute myeloid leukemia. And I'll just tell you quickly what's unique about it. As with the Parker Institute, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society is the IND holder. And we've used our ability to interact with the FDA and with the pharmaceutical industry and with academic medicine to pull together a trial very, very quickly. It's focused on acute myeloid leukemia, and it enrolls newly diagnosed AML patients over the age of 60. You heard Dr. Matsui say that older patients are the most difficult to treat. We want to give these patients, this is a cohort, 60 over the age of 60, newly diagnosed with AML, for which the current standard of care does not work. Fewer than 1 in 5 patients will be alive 5 years out. So we wanted to give these patients a shot at a novel targeted agent based on their genetics. This is a precision medicine driven trial. So just to map it out for you, we're enrolling newly diagnosed patients over the age of 60. We delay treatment for 7 days while Foundation Medicine helps us turn around the genetic profile of the patient's AML. Based on the genetic profile, we assign them to an arm of the trial with a targeted investigational agent that should pay them benefit. Most clinical trials, as you know, test one drug at a time. This isn't fast enough for an organization that's driven by the urgency of patients. This trial has 9 active arms open currently at 11 different sites around the country. So as with the I-SPY 2 or 3, I'm not sure which iteration it is, we're looking for very large effects from targeted investigational agents, small cohorts to begin with. If we see a 50% or greater improvement over standard of care, we'll expand to larger cohorts. We've pledged to the FDA that we will run this trial with industry quality, and their pledge back is they will consider the data for registration. So 9 agents, very rapidly moving forward. We opened the trial 18 months ago. We have well over 250 patients enrolled already. If you design the trial right, and physicians like it, and patients like it, they will enroll. Well over 250 patients enrolled, and substantial progress toward being able to put data in front of the FDA in the not-too-distant future. I'll just add one tidbit. Because the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society is involved as the IND holder and as a third-party neutral, if you will, we've been able to engage 2 pharmaceutical companies with competing agents in AML to agree to put their agents together in a novel combination as an arm of this study. And again, you heard Ken Anderson and others talk about the importance of combinations. We will put forward as an arm of this trial one of the first ever novel combinations going forward. And I attribute that to the fact that it's a not-for-profit that's really at the center driving this program.
Excellent. Switch a little bit to talk about intellectual property. And maybe, I don't know, what, Lorraine, if you want to talk about what you do at Damon Runyon, or you, Bremi, you want to talk about some of your stuff. But the question always with the pharma companies, and I'll defer to folks in the audience, is when they're working with foundations, it looks like free money, but it's not necessarily 100% free. So maybe you'd like to comment on that.
Well, we have a policy, you know, we're funding mostly basic research, but we actually, with our relationship, IP relationship is with our academic institutions, and we do ask for a percentage of any royalties that come out of work where we contributed some or all of the funding. So I can tell you that we actually have a very, very small interest in the CRISPR technology out of the Broad, for example, thanks to Feng Zhang, who we funded as an early career scientist. And so we're watching the patent litigation with some interest. Although that's not why we're in it, so it doesn't matter whatever way it comes out. But it is a way to potentially be able to do more if something that we funded really takes off.
So lawyers from the Damon Runyon will be calling you very shortly about your CRISPR Cas9. Rami?
No, I think the IP, and I'm sure it will be consistent across different organizations. So we don't own IPs. If it's a drug IP and a company is developing that drug, our goal is not to block the company or prevent the company from advancing their drug and eventually making them available to patients. So we don't gain anything. If we generate data that can inform how drug X and drug Y can be used, we want companies to have full access to this data so that, again, the whole idea is to take it to the next step. Our IPs stay with the academic institutes, so they are owned by the academic institutes. What we are doing is just helping them manage the IP. So if an IP can become something that's druggable, we bring companies to those institutes so that they can turn this new target into an actual drug. We can help them putting an IND together so that this becomes from an early discovery asset into something that's actually a clinical asset. So we just provide the support that discoveries can really advance into the clinic. When we do clinical trials, if there's a new discovery that has nothing to do with the drugs that are being tested, then this new discovery, if it leads to a patent, then the institute where the discovery happened will own that IP. But again, as long as it doesn't impact how the combination can be used or how the combination can be advanced.
So let me answer the IP question.
TG, you're on deck. I got a question for you.
By going back to the question you asked about the importance of funding on the part of not-for-profits, I think what's really important here is the amount of time and effort it really takes to develop one of these therapies and the work that has to go on in the laboratory. So the example I'll give you is CAR T therapy. And I'll give you a very specific example. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society began funding Carl June's work at UPenn in 1998. And from 1998 and through 2012, 2013, when this all went public and Novartis saw value in it, LLS had invested over $21 million into that program. And I think if Carl were here, he would tell you that he had difficulty raising funds from the National Cancer Institute or for the National Institutes of Health, from other funding agencies. You know, it took an agency focused on the blood cancers, willing to take more risk, which is what I think we do, willing to take more risk and allowing a consistent funding source over that long period of time that really helped to advance that therapy. And so the answer to the second part of your question, yes, we have an IP policy a lot like what Lorraine described, and we saw some dollars come back from UPenn because of the licensing to Novartis.
It's fantastic to get a round trip on those things, so congratulations, man. TJ, I want to switch topics for a second. Talk about social media. You do blogging, you communicate with a lot of folks. It's absolutely changing the landscape in terms of recruitment. I'll talk a little bit about what you're doing there.
Yeah. The world of social media has done what advocacy groups traditionally did in the past. It's bringing people together in a way that it's almost hard to comprehend. I sound like my dad, I guess, but every time I go onto social media, I see something else where another group of patients or another group of concerned individuals or invested people are banding together. You know, breast cancer, BCSM is one of the original hashtags that really brought together a lot of breast cancer patients. And that has sort of opened up the floodgates for patients to directly communicate about the choices they have in treatment, including clinical trials, about what's happening on a treatment. I know when I want to know what happened on my treatment or my trial, I went on Facebook, and that's where I found the best answers. So I found patients that were on either my anti-PD-1 trial or a very similar one, and they gave me very concise, very accurate, very relevant feedback. When I went to my physician, he didn't really have a lot of that. And the stark difference between getting immediate feedback when you need it versus waiting 13 years for Carl June to finish a study is amazing. And it's the opportunity that the industry would be very wise to take advantage of, because it's happening whether you like it or not. So there is certainly an opportunity for us as patients advocacy groups who can help, I don't want to say moderate, but bring the forces together to let people who are going through a similar experience take that collective knowledge and use it for something good.
Can I ask you a question on that topic, because I'm honored?
There's a mic right there.
Sure.
This, by the way, is Michael King, one of the top analysts on Wall Street.
Yeah, so I'm Mike King. I'm a biotechnology industry analyst, and I follow a lot of oncology names. I monitor the discussion board at Inspire, mm-hmm. at Team Inspire, and I want, to see the conversations that are happening in lung cancer, for example. But let's say you put yourself in the CEO slot of a biotech company who's now watching a narrative unfold in front of the whole world, because obviously investors, hedge funds are mm-hmm. looking at this stuff. What's your advice to the CEOs who are spending shareholder money, have a report, a board to report to, when these things get out on social media?
It's ironic, because I actually wrote shareholders versus customers as one of my notes, and that's a conversation I've had repeatedly.
It should be versus, though.
you touched on a really good point. Like, that's really what happens there. You know, when you get from a small biotech into a very large pharmaceutical company, and acquisitions happen, all of a sudden there is a financial responsibility. And now you start looking at, okay, you can't really have two masters here. Are you going to answer to the shareholders? That's going to be different than being patient-centric. Everyone wants to say that. But are you able to actually provide not just a value to a customer? I use that word a lot, because I think of myself as a consumer of pharmaceutical goods. But are you actually providing the best value? Are you providing the value that you would want your spouse to get, or your parent, or, God forbid, your child, if they had to consume that? And when you start thinking of it in that mindset, and not the, we're going to miss earnings because, some idiot blogger decided to tweet out, his trial results, it becomes a lot more human. It becomes those 10 kids that were over there who don't understand how this world works but want to make a difference. That's really what I would give back to that CEO and say, this is going to affect all of us. Do what you have to do so if and when it affects you, you can say that I made the best decision for the people that my company will affect.
Can I ask TJ a question? So a while ago, we surveyed patients, and one of the responses we got back was that there was too much information and they didn't know what to trust. So I wonder how if you have any thoughts about that. How do patients parse out the information that they find on the web, whether it's Facebook mm-hmm. or, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society website or anywhere else?
How much more time do we have for this one? Because I could probably talk all day. My quick thought on that is that, yes, it's overwhelming. I mentioned it earlier, when you get a diagnosis, you just kind of got hit, by a tidal wave. And now you're looking. I got links to everything. I got great information. And I also got the cousin's aunt who had, honey and baking soda that cured her cancer. It's hard to filter. And that's one of the reasons that I kind of espouse a network of of educated patients, of people who do write blogs or are moderators on Inspire sites. I do that for the Melanoma Research Alliance, who can guide patients to good information. And you know, on your side for it, it's encouraging that information to be there for patients, not just in a, you know, company XYZ has a website about our immunotherapy, but this is, you know, this is a, you know, the, I bring up the MRA a couple times because they do facilitate some of that information sharing. It's what will make a difference in patients, because when you get diagnosed, you don't know where to go. And having a trusted source of information that, hey, maybe your doctor also uses that, because guess what? Doctors also go and Google treatment information, because I know my doctors have done it multiple times. Being able to speak from that trusted source will make a huge difference. It's a matter of pulling all that together, not just the social media part, but really what, you know, what a diagnosis is, what the next steps would be, and the available treatments, including trials. And it kind of brings us back to what, you know, we're talking about here.
Question for the audience.
Hi, Wendy Seelig, WS Collaborative. So Lou and Rami, you both talked about examples of trials with a nonprofit holding the IND, and you talked about some of the value proposition for that. Can you talk a little bit more about getting up over the hurdle with companies wanting to relinquish some control and sort of what the trade-offs have been? I've been doing some work in the pancreatic cancer space where they're also trying to advance a master protocol trial with multiple arms. You're further along, Lou, but I think one of the things that we're used to in industry is this idea of keeping everything in-house, keeping control of everything, wanting to own everything, being risk-averse. Can you talk a little bit about how you sort of crossed over that hurdle?
So, I mean, I can start. All companies, regardless of their size, they have capacity. And right now, with the number of combinations that are being explored, many of those companies are reaching the realization that they cannot do everything themselves. If they decided that they want to control all the combinations, then they will have to prioritize few, but then there will be some that will not be done. So for most companies, when we propose something to them, it's usually something that's not redundant, something that they are not doing already, so they see a value here. With regards to they want to be involved, actually, we want them to be involved because they are the expert when it comes to their molecule. They are sitting on the database that has all the information about their molecule. So actually, we invite companies to help us with the design of the study. There's no reason for us to say, this is a Parker-sponsored study, so we will have to make a decision about the endpoint. When we have those discussions, we bring the scientists, we bring the oncologists, we bring the companies, and we all sit together and figure out what would be the appropriate endpoint in that study. So once you make the companies really realize that they will be part of the decision, then there's nothing that will make them shy away from doing this, because they feel that they have access to the design, they have access to the data. So, I mean, so far, again, obviously we are very early days, so I cannot say, oh, it's easy, because right now it's just an N of one. But we have established partnerships with multiple companies, and so far they are interested in being part of this.
It's a great question, Wendy. I'll take you back to one of the things I said early on, and that is the kind of relationship that a not-for-profit can have with the FDA. So the first place we went to with the idea behind this trial and a rough idea of what the protocol would be was to the FDA. And we got their guidance about how to design it. I think the tipping point with respect to industry for us, the initial tipping point, was a meeting that we had after we had come to agreement with the FDA on what the protocol could look like. The invitees to the meeting were representatives of the pharmaceutical companies that we wanted to work with, and we discussed the protocol, and then two senior members of the FDA stood up and said, we endorse this trial. And that was a real tipping point that opened the doors to some, not all, pharmaceutical companies. So some came in immediately. Others, have stood on the sidelines and watched and saw what's happened. What we've been able to show the lingerers is the fact that we brought new technology to play. I mentioned we're open in 11 sites. Every site has the equivalent of a Facebook page of the trial. They have a running electronic view of exactly every decision that's made in every site all across the trial. We've put in place a centralized database The clinical sites have their own databases, but we've insisted that they populate a centralized database that allows us to do remote monitoring and also allows us to be FDA ready at the drop of a hat. All of this and other things like insisting on a central IRB has allowed us to run this trial at a 25 to 30% discount, cost discount, compared to a typical industry trial. And so when those that were on the sidelines saw our ability to accrue patients, they saw the new technologies we were bringing and the cost savings, they've come in as well.
Thank you, Lou. Question?
Jeremy, when this panel started, a lot of the themes you began with, improving clinical trial participation, advancing therapies in general, having people work together, it sounds a lot like many of the things we were so excited about 2 years ago with the cancer moonshot. So I'm unaware, does that still exist? Is there money? Are there any external champions to make this ecosystem work better? What's happened to that?
It's a fair question. I don't have the financial answer to the budget financing. Maybe somebody else does have information. The moonshot thesis was exactly this thesis of closer collaboration. Started with tremendous support from the White House at the time. And as I think a few people are aware, the White House has changed since then. There's been a few changes in support for some of these programs, in case anyone's been on Mars or Jupiter for the last year and a few months. But I think the underlying thesis of support for institutions is still there, and many of that group continues to meet and continues to do things. Dr. Esmond?
Yeah, so there is in the budget from last year that got passed, there's money specifically in for moonshot type grants that are really about trying to build, you know, common IT infrastructure.
Right.
This is an issue. I don't think people deliberately don't want to collaborate, but it's just so hard because I think the lesion in all the systems is the failure of our electronic medical record systems. I mean, we've electronified the paper process, and physicians are suffering writing, you know, long, complex, ridiculous notes that have no ability to search and provide feedback on performance. And I think we need a quality improvement layer on top that is structured and allows us to seamlessly integrate care and research. I think we have to change the way our IRBs are organized. I think that, you know, the idea that you have to get permission to look at your data from an IRB is really completely ridiculous. That really should be, I find that infuriating, because that should be a part of clinical practice. You know, you should have to go to your IRB to not look at your data and get feedback. But I think these are, you know, there needs to be some real infrastructure investment across, you know, all these organizations, you know, and this on a not-for-profit basis. I mean, I would love to see the NCI do it, but as they say, their purview is research, not care. I submit that if we don't change our clinical systems of care, we will forever be damned to have these completely inefficient clinical research systems. And I think, you know, certainly, you know, when we started iSpy, there hadn't been people working together. No one's died. Nothing terrible has happened. You know, it's really, I think people are following the model and making it work in many other situations. And I would love to see the cooperative groups evolve to having, you know, common platform trials for all their diseases. It would be a much more efficient way to do things. And I think another problem is credit and how credit is given. The reason why people write special protocols and independent protocols is because that's academic credit. You know, what I've done, and I think you followed a lot of it, is, you know, every drug that comes in, people are a chaperone. They get credit for each thing, so you find lots of different ways. Writing the protocol again, I mean, what a total waste of time that is. You know, going to 25 IRBs, what a total waste of time that is. Nobody, that's just wasted throwaway money, right? So I think people just need to step up and say, wow, why are we keeping on doing these incredibly stupid things that waste everybody's time? And if people are just so used to it, they kind of go, oh, okay, I guess that's the way I have to do it. But, I mean, all, you know, you're seeing a lot of this change from the outside. Again, independent groups of people. Yeah, I mean, we started originally with the FNIH, and now we have, Quantum Leap as our sponsor. It's just you have to have an independent broker, because no one institution, who's going to, like, trust one institution with everyone else's data? That just doesn't happen. You know, eventually, you know, the NCI or someone else could do that. But this is really what Biden was trying to get at. But the funny thing is, and there is still, he has a foundation, and they're still working on it. The funny thing is that, you know, NCI has to change as well. And, you know, I think the NCI isn't as innovative in these ways as the FDA, actually.
Thank you very much. Before we wrap up, one last question for the panelists before break. One thing that's going to change in terms of innovative trials, collaborative initiatives, if we come back in 3 years. Lou, you can start.
Well, I'm going to stick my neck way out here. I think that one of the most important things we could do to advance therapies across the board more quickly would be to reorient how the FDA reports. So the FDA now reports to Congress. What if we could make the FDA more like the Fed, your politics aside here, but independent like the Federal Reserve, where the commissioner is not an political appointee? I think this would reduce the risk-averse nature of the FDA even more. They've been remarkable in oncology lately, but it could reduce the risk-averse nature of the organization, and I think it could speed up the development of and approval of new treatments in a dramatic way.
Wow. Lorraine, you're up.
Wow. Good luck with that one, Lou. I would say that I'm seeing now, you know, it wasn't that many years ago that people said pharma companies wouldn't work with each other and you would never be able to do these combination clinical trials and all that. And I see a sea change happening. I see it in the applicants we get who are now totally innovating on how they think about how to structure clinical trials. And I am blown away, you know, I told Lou this, by what he's doing with his AML trial. I think what you're doing is amazing. And these neutral conveners of clinical trials is really groundbreaking. So I'd vote for these guys in terms of, you know, the kinds of revolutions we need to see.
Great, thank you. Remy?
Yes, I mean, while Lou restructuring the government, I think we need to...
Revolution.
No, so I think we need to do more of the platform kind of studies where we very quickly can make decisions about what's working and what's not working. And I think the what's not working part is very important. When we were doing the prep for this panel, we've talked about the fact that we're not learning from studies that are not meeting the primary endpoint. Companies will move on to the next combination because they have something in the pipeline. But what about the thousands of patients who have been exposed to this combination because we were hoping that this would be the new best therapy? So I think we really need to start changing the model where we as nonprofit, we can afford spending the time figuring out why X and Y did not work, although the early data suggested that it should work. While I understand that companies cannot spend their resources doing this, but again, I think groups like us, we can spend time trying to figure out why something that appeared to be exciting in the beginning but later on did not deliver.
TJ, you get the last word.
All right. I think these guys are onto a lot of things, and I do think that the bigger groups, like a Parker Institute, have the clout to change the way that this copycat industry can work. Right now we have a bunch of immuno-oncology trials and they probably all look pretty the same, mm-hmm. With just one little thing changed here and one little thing changed there, and we're aiming to get right here and right here and right here. And someone needs to say, we're breaking this mold. We're going to take a trial, we're going to structure it in a way that is going to get us exponential gains. We're going to report on it so that patients find out the information as soon as they possibly can so they can make good decisions for them. And then we're going to make those endpoints so it means something to those patients, to the physicians, and structure that. And as soon as a trial like that works and you get this amazing result, yeah, maybe those guys on the sidelines say, we should try that too. And we're not all of a sudden just aiming for, you know, we're not aiming too low and reaching our goal, but we're aiming high and maybe getting there.
Please thank our panelists.